From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a celebration marks the opening of the long-awaited Gordie Howe Bridge. And American officials were not invited.
Our relationship has been challenged over the last few years. And President Trump has threatened new tariffs just this month. But Team Canada has never been more united.
Then, how the war in Gaza has shifted the opinions of Michigan's Jewish voters ahead of a tightly contested Democratic primary.
Jews who might consider themselves sort of traditionally pro-Israel, in whatever way you want to define that, they have come to see themselves as really politically homeless in a lot of ways.
And a book from a Michigan author about the many perils faced by North American birds for hundreds of years.
It really turned into these ostentatious hats that had feathers, that had stuffed birds.
All that coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. A little bit later this hour, we'll speak with an author about his book on the long history of conservation and threats against American birds. From Victorian hats to feral cats. That's later in today's show. But first, this is a big day in Southeast Michigan, although you might not believe it based on the tempered celebration. The decades-long construction of the Gordie Howe Bridge spanning Detroit and Windsor officially opens today. It took years of negotiations to get Michigan and Canada to agree on the terms of this project, and many, many more years to build the span itself. In these final months before the opening, the politics of the Trump administration slowed the opening again. And it is that last part that is the reason today for a fairly quiet bridge opening. I'm standing here in the Delray neighborhood of Detroit, looking up at the bridge. You see a couple of flags. I see one CBC truck, but overall, it's a pretty scaled back celebration. Russ McNamara of public radio station WDET covered the opening today, and he joins us now to tell us what he saw. Hey, Russ, welcome.
Happy to be here. Love the show.
Russ, this ceremony was in doubt in many ways. What it would be, when it would be, where it would be held, it felt like all the way up until this week. Can you tell us who was there today?
Yeah, it was all the way up until last night. I wasn't even sure this thing was happening until around 5:30 yesterday when I got my formal invite. It was not brought by unicorns or anything like that. It was just a standard email. for this, we had Ontario Premier Doug Ford. They had the Minister of Infrastructure there today. Of course, Windsor Mayor Drew Dilkins was there. We had many delegations from the Howe family there as well, including Dr. Murray Howe, who spoke. People were in a good mood for this. Obviously, Prime Minister Mark Carney did not come to this one, and that was maybe a little bit of a surprise. But aside from that, I thought the turnout was pretty good, about 500 people, I'd guess.
Was there any mention at this Canadian ceremony of the current political climate or the acrimony over politics and tariffs?
In true Canadian fashion, the acrimony was mostly limited in this one. Just a brief allusion by the normally very quotable Premier Ford about maybe, you know, some misgivings between the two countries right now. The most blatant we had was from Windsor Mayor Drew Dilkins, who said that if Gordie Howe was here right now, he would probably check this one person into the boards. And you can all guess who that one person is. But mostly, you know, the president, our president, was treated with bemusement. And everybody kind of just seemed, you know, excited and happy over the bridge finally being done and set to open. And maybe just a little bit sad because there wasn't anybody from the Michigan delegation there. And they were highly complimentary of the folks from Michigan who helped get this deal done. And they were mostly just like happy, which is kind of weird, but not from a Canadian standpoint, I guess.
Sure. I wouldn't expect you to know this, Russ, since you were at the ceremony and reporting. But while this was going on, President Trump was on social media talking about how he got a better deal out of the bridge.
I wonder if his ears were burning with the reference of Gordie Howe checking somebody into the boards.
Well, his ears are constantly burning, and he's constantly on Truth Social.
Yeah,
that's part of it. But he didn't come up, and he didn't get mentioned really directly. Dr. Murray Howe thanked him for helping to get this done. And we didn't really get a formal mention of President Trump by the dignitaries there, just brief allusions. But the president can say he got a better deal. That's not how the Canadian folks feel about it, because the deal that was signed within, you know, recent days, it talks about America getting a share of the net profits. Well, they're not expecting net profits. They're paying down debt and construction costs over the next 50 years, they figure. So, yeah, they're like, well, yeah, sure, they can have net profits, but like, there's not going to be any.
Sure. I got a far away view of the bridge. Russ, I was standing down in Delray this morning, you know, looking at the new span. But may I just ask what it was like being out on the bridge and one of the first civilians to set foot on it?
Well, they didn't get us. They didn't let us get too close. I tried. And some very nice Windsor police officers were like, oh, yeah, you can't get too far. Now, Premier Ontario Premier Doug Ford was given a ride out there. And I guess a small delegation went out to the middle of the bridge, the halfway point where there are American and Canadian flags. But it is immense. It looks pretty cool. It looks an awful lot like the bridge that we've seen done in Toledo for over a decade. And it's pretty sweet. And it is hulking and immense. And, you know, the toll plazas are all brand new and slick and meant to move a lot of cars and an awful lot of trucks. And if you've crossed the border via the Ambassador Bridge or the Detroit Windsor Tunnel, you know how important it is to have a lot of lanes available for traffic, because the backups are often immense.
Very real. Was there any discussion today about when we, the normies, will get to cross? Is that something that's going to start this weekend?
The normies will get to cross on Monday afternoon. They're shooting for around 1 o'clock on Monday afternoon. So they want, you know, a morning to get prepared and everything going on. And signage will come down on both the American and Canadian side. And the floodgates will open, and I'm guessing it'll start with a steady trickle, and then people will notice that they can use it, and then they'll try it out.
Russ, as a Detroiter, do you have any plans to walk or ride a bike across the span once it's open?
I will, and I'm excited for that to finally be a reality. I mean, people have wanted that for a very long time. Running in the half marathon, the Detroit Free Press half marathon, I've run over the Ambassador Bridge a few times, but to be able to do it recreationally and not wanting to die is a very, very good thing. But that particular mode of travel will not be open for another couple of weeks. They want to be able to get settled before they have to start dealing with bikers and pedestrians.
Russ, from your position at WDET in Detroit, you have been following the story of the Gordie Howe International Bridge for a good long time now. And I just wonder if you have been surprised, if you know, Russ 10 years ago would have been shocked at the twists and turns that this has taken in just the past year.
You know, the twists and turns, no, because it seems like any major project in Detroit, there is always going to be some other threat and some other thing that comes up, whether it's funding or political action, something like that. But the fact that it's finally done is somewhat of a surprise, and it's a relief too, because, you know, I-75 downriver is one of the most frequently traveled spots in the entire area, and as an international crossing and a business corridor, it's highly visible. And now this is a nice, very positive and good thing for the city, both the residents who live here and industry and commerce. So it's a relief that it's finally gotten to this point.
Yeah. Folks may be aware that one of the major opponents to this bridge all the way along up until the, you know, the midway months of this year is the Maroon family, whose business interests in Detroit include the Ambassador Bridge down the river a bit from the Gordie Howe Bridge. Have you learned anything about how the Gordie Howe Bridge is going to impact tolling on the Ambassador Bridge or traffic through the area?
They're not saying really about, you know, if they're going to change the tolls at all, because as we know, competition can help that out a little bit. That's the good thing of capitalism. Some competition will drive the prices down. They are planning to offer lower tolls on the Gordie Howe International Bridge. And now if you're an owner of a trucker, a trucking company, you're telling your guys you want to go through there. And so having the other bridge is definitely going to lessen the traffic on the Ambassador Bridge. So people might just find it more convenient, actually, and close. If they're making, you know, if you're making that drive from, you know, the east side, well, it is closer to use the Ambassador or the tunnel, something like that. But if you're coming from the south and the west, the Gordie Howe is going to be way more convenient to you and cheaper. So it might actually make a quick trip over to Windsor a quick trip, which would be fantastic for the people of Windsor. I did a series of stories last year about how it was working out for the businesses in Windsor, and they, you know, the hospitality industry over there was still hurting from the pandemic, and because people from Detroit used to cross more often, and then they just kind of stopped, and they were starting to trickle back over, and now the tensions between the two countries really hurt all of that. And so I'm eager to get back over and talk with some of the folks that I did last year about how they feel about the bridge opening, if that's leading to some more foot traffic, to just some more customers, because they have been ready for this bridge to be open for a very long time.
No question. I'm looking forward to a few more trips per year to Shanghai Bistro for dumplings myself on the Windsor side.
Yes, you know the good stuff.
Real quickly, Russ, do you know, is the expectation that traffic will go down a full third now that we have the Ambassador Bridge, the tunnel under the river, and the Gordie Howe span?
That's the numbers that they're throwing out there. You know, until it actually plays out, I'm a little bit skeptical, but my goodness, you know, having it, it might drop even further, Ambassador, just because people, you know, always want to try the new thing, right? I mean, the capacity that they can put through the new toll plazas is significant. And so so that might move things along.
Russ McNamara, catch him on the airwaves at WDET. Russ, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Time for a break. When we come back, a journalist covering the Jewish perspective on the U.S. Senate race in Michigan. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This summer's competitive Democratic primary for a U.S. Senate seat in Michigan is testing loyalties for a lot of voters, none perhaps more so than Michigan's Jewish voters. The leading candidates on the Democratic side are sharply divided on U.S. policies toward Israel. Everyone, from strong Zionists to pro-Palestinian progressives, are considering and reconsidering their options for the primary election and beyond. Haley Stevens, a congresswoman who represents part of Oakland County, has counted herself a supporter of Israel, although she says she takes issue with some recent policy decisions. Abdul Al-Sayed, an MD who's also running, has called Israel's actions in Gaza a genocide, and he's questioned whether Israel's future lies with its identity as, first and foremost, a Jewish state. Among the reporters covering the primary this season are Andrew Lapin, senior reporter with the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and he published recently about the race. Andrew, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you, April. Great to be here.
So, many people who you've talked to are voting with a double consciousness. They're Americans. They're also Jews who have relationships with Israel, with people in Israel, sometimes with family in Israel. And many of the folks that you spoke with have supported and always supported a Jewish state. In that language, Haley Stevens is someone who might fit their orientation. Can you talk about the voters you started running across who felt very strongly about this and why they object to Abdul El-Sayed's candidacy.
Yes, absolutely. So many of the Jewish voters I've talked to in Michigan belong to what you would think of as the class of Jewish community and institutional leaders, or the Jewish donor class. So they set a lot of the tenor and the priorities for kind of how the broader Jewish community in the state thinks about these things. And they're very concerned with a number of things that Abdul El-Sayed has said. You mentioned some of his rhetoric on Israel, which is actually tacked kind of even further than many other pro-Palestinian politicians on the world stage right now, questioning whether it should be a Jewish state, recently commenting to CNN that he thought Democrats who supported Israel might only be doing so for a financial motivation, so sort of discounting an emotional attachment to Israel in that equation.
I should note that AIPAC has been a big spender in this particular Senate race.
Yes, absolutely.
He was suggesting that Democrats who support Israel would only do so for financial reasons. I don't know that the blanket statement would necessarily apply.
Right. But he has also said things that have concerned Michigan Jews about things closer to home. His response to the attack earlier this year at Temple Israel in West Bloomfield was a big dividing point. You know, at first, he issued what you might expect a politician to say, which was a sort of blanket condemnation of the attack, of violence, of targeting religious institutions. After the identity of the attacker was revealed to be a Dearborn resident who had lost family after an Israeli operation on a Hezbollah site in Lebanon, he issued a new statement where he said, hurt people hurt people. And this was considered very offensive to a lot of folks in the Jewish community.
Implying that people who have suffered during wartime might turn and inflict suffering on others, I think was what he meant.
Yes, yeah. That's what he says. But the Jewish community took it as almost building a permission structure to link an attack on a synagogue in their state with events that were happening in Israel and Lebanon, and sort of creating a means by which one might be able to justify or explain away that attack, which was considered very offensive. And this is also happening in a larger context of the sort of larger civil war within the Democratic Party, which we saw play out at the Michigan State Democratic Convention earlier this year, when Amir Makled, who was a lawyer for the pro-Palestinian encampments here at the University of Michigan, who had a social media history of supporting Hezbollah and of retweeting Candace Owens, the far-right anti-Semitic conspiracy theorist, received the state Democratic nomination for University of Michigan Board of Regents. And so a lot of the Jews I spoke to were mentioning the events of that convention, saying how uncomfortable and unsafe they felt there. And they viewed a potential El-Sayed nomination on the ticket as the last straw that might encourage many of them to instead vote for or even actively fundraise for the Republican.
Yeah. What was the range of actions or considerations that the voters you talked to were considering if Abdul El-Sayed is successful in the Democratic primary?
Yeah, this people who had described themselves to me as lifelong Democrats, as believers in liberal policies, many aspects of the Democratic Party agenda, were starting to say things like, I would actively fundraise for Mike Rogers, the Republican, if Abdul were to receive the nomination. Or I would encourage my friends to vote for Mike Rogers, and I would tell them all the reasons why. Or I would simply leave the ballot blank. And it was pretty striking for me to hear several of the people I was talking to say that they were putting their own people first, their own sense of personal safety, and what they thought of as what should be a very strong commitment to the U.S.-Israel relationship over any number of other policy issues that are driving these midterm elections right now. And that was kind of surprising to hear.
The way that you related this in your story was that people who have traditionally fundraised for Democrats were considering planning these fundraisers for the presumptive GOP nominee, Mike Rogers, if Abdul El-Sayed were to win. I mean, I know from my time reporting on politics that people who organize these things for campaigns, you know, if they're talking about their opposition, some of the things they say will happen might come to pass. Sometimes they don't. What's your sense of whether this is fear talking or whether this is something that people might actually consider doing?
It's a great question. It's always difficult to get people to wrestle with the hypothetical, right? And so some people, I have no doubt, are serious when they say this. But I recently spoke with Andy Levin, the former congressman who is Jewish, who is a big Abdul supporter himself. He and his political family have been involved in Michigan politics for many years. Levin told me, look, this is nothing new. We have constantly been hearing from a certain subsection of Jews in the state who are pro-Israel hardliners, who have been pushing myself, my father, my uncle, this is Sandra Levin and Carl Levin, to the right on Israel issues, who have threatened to withhold support if they didn't get their way, and it's never come to pass. And so he does not take these threats seriously, but a number of other Jewish community officials in the state, particularly in the Detroit area, who have been around the block, have been, active participants in the Democratic Party for many years, have left leadership positions within the party because of their unease over its direction, and seem much more determined to do whatever it takes to make sure Al-Sayed would not win in November.
The quote in the article from one voter who said, "I'm putting our people first," by which he means Jewish people, "and our country second," by which, he meant the United States election process. It seems unusual to hear and kind of remarkable given the Jewish Americans' long road towards some kind of assimilation and some kind of mainstreaming in this country. What did hearing him say that bring up for you?
Well, one thing it made me think of was that to the wrong ears, this sounds like playing into some of the more pernicious stereotypes about Jewish power in this country, the idea that Jews are some kind of single-issue voting bloc, or that Jews are a single malevolent force represented by AIPAC, represented by, sort of pro-Israel demons in the shadows, who have some kind of ostentatious ability to control elections. That was certainly concerning, but my sources who were talking to me and saying those kinds of things, they were speaking from a place of genuine emotion and fear. They really felt like their position within the Democratic Party has been completely destabilized by the last few years of what they see as an abandoning of traditional issues within the party, don't want to perpetuate any sort of demonization or unsafe rhetoric that would reflect back on the Jewish population at home, to make sure that those Jews also feel safe within the party.
Part of the reason that this issue has been so top of mind for people was a recent vote in Congress. Earlier this month, a renegade Republican House member named Thomas Massie sponsored this amendment that would have cut off aid for Israel. It failed. Massie was the only Republican House member who voted for it. But what really got people's attention was how many Democrats signed on. 103 Democrats. It was a slim majority of Democratic members in the House caucus. What would you say that communicates to the voters you talked to?
Well, I did speak to the voters before this vote was taken, but I think it speaks to just how central of an issue Israel has become within intra-party politics, and how worrisome Jews who might consider themselves sort of traditionally pro-Israel, in whatever way you want to define that, how they have come to see themselves as really politically homeless in a lot of ways. And Michigan, because our primary is coming up soon, because these issues are being debated on a statewide level in a purple swing state, feels very much like the bellwether for where the future of this party and the future of these kinds of conversations about Israel are heading.
This has to be an outstandingly strange moment for Jewish voters. On the right, figures like J.D. Vance exchanging conspiracy theories about Israel with Joe Rogan on Rogan's podcast, and also things like the attack on Temple Israel happening. Can you say more about the life experiences that you think really have compelled voters to take another hard look at their vote?
Absolutely. Something I've learned talking to Jews out there in the electorate is that they are certainly aware of the threats of right-wing anti-Semitism. Very few of them at this point in time would back J.D. Vance. I think for Jewish conservatives, they are much more behind Marco Rubio. Beyond that, there is a sense from those Jews who see themselves as politically homeless that they actually have to start evaluating individual candidates based on their merits, based on the issues that ring true to them. And an example of this is that some of those same Jewish communal leaders who think of themselves as lifelong Democrats are currently engaged in an effort to convince Jewish and pro-Israel Republicans to vote Democrat in the primary, specifically to help Haley Stevens, even if those Republicans have no plan of voting for Stevens in the general.
A Republican crossover vote.
Yes.
Wow. I mean, I know Michigan's kind of notorious for ticket splitters, but that's a step further. If you're just joining us, my guest is Andrew Lapin, a senior reporter for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and he's recently written about voters considering their options for a U.S. Senate seat and the primary that is happening in the Democratic Party. I'd like to note that Abdul Al-Sayed has attended some Jewish holiday dinners, has done some events trying to court maybe a Jewish progressive or a Jewish moderate vote. I've heard him say at campaign events that AIPAC and Israel are not the same as Judaism and the Jewish people. Did you talk to many voters who said that they are thinking about voting for him or saying that, yes, you know, I would vote for this guy if he gets through the primary?
I've talked to Jewish Al-Sayed voters. He has a few, although not many, Jewish campaign surrogates. I've also attended and watched rallies of his where he has said that kind of language, which, you know, is certainly hopefully good for the body politic. But his other comments continue to rub a lot of Jewish voters the wrong way. And I think were he to win the Democratic nomination, he would have a lot of work to do if he was sincerely interested in building trust within the Jewish community. The Jews who said that they would still consider voting for him or fundraising for him, who I've talked to, are Jews who put their identity as Democrats very much front and center and talk about how in the greater good, other causes like the Supreme Court, other causes like President Trump's, you know, various machinations while in office and trying to put a stop to that would weigh higher than Israel for them. But that's not going to be true of every voter. I want to also add very quickly, so a lot of people now know who Hassan Piker is after Al-Sayed campaigned with him. He's this left-wing, you know, streamer who was very vocal on Israel. So after he came to Michigan and held his rally with Al-Sayed, I had a long sit-down with Piker where I asked him about his views. And he told me, look, if I had my way, the Democratic Party as a whole would be entirely anti-Israel, and I think Jews would continue to vote for us because their other concerns would outweigh Israel. And from the reporting I've done in recent weeks, Michigan is very much a test case for what that kind of debate would look like. That is very much not a sure thing in the Jewish electorate.
You know, it brings to mind a story that you wrote a couple of weeks ago about a relatively recent survey that was conducted out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, by a Jewish group that found fewer than half of Jewish Americans now identify as Zionist. Now, this is not the first survey suggesting that might be true and that something might be changing, but it does seem to underline a shift in Jewish American identity. Would you say if people do not identify as overtly Zionist, what are they? How are there words that people use to describe that relationship?
This is a great question, and it's an area of coverage I'm really interested in focusing on. There have been several surveys from Jewish federations around the country, including the National Umbrella Group, that have asked some version of this question, do Jews identify as Zionist? We frequently see that fewer than half of Jews in any given population say that they do. At the same time, that same population of Jews, the vast majority of them, sometimes as many as 9 in 10, say they agree with the fundamental tenets of Zionism or of liberal Zionism, mainly that Israel should be a Jewish state, that Israel has importance to the Jewish people, and that, you know, ideally Israel would also be a democracy. And so this is revealing, I think, of a fundamental contradiction or maybe even a confusion in how we define Zionism, how that term has morphed as a result of post-October 7th activism, and how Jews see themselves. Are they all confused? Do they just not know the definition? I don't think that's necessarily true. I think they are finding that that label no longer serves to encompass the full complexity of how they think about their relationship to Israel.
A lot of people, analysts and voters who are watching this race, have voted that the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, as it's commonly known, has been involved and has given millions in support of Haley Stevens. And sometimes it seems like their bundled funds have ended up running opposition ads against Abdul El-Sayed directly. Can you say a little bit more about the role that donors to AIPAC feel that it's supposed to be playing right now?
Absolutely, yes. AIPAC has become a huge talking point in this race. Most of Abdul's attack lines against Haley Stevens focus on the millions of dollars she has benefited from AIPAC spending. And you can find, it's not hard to find, Instagram videos. I saw one the other day of a Jewish mother talking to Stevens on the campaign trail and asking her about AIPAC, and Stevens just walking away, completely ignoring her. So the growing toxicity of that brand is certainly a liability for her campaign. The Jewish donors who I talk to, some of whom support AIPAC or have donated to them, some of whom don't necessarily agree with AIPAC or what AIPAC has become today, they resent this line of attack because to them, AIPAC is just another lobbying group. It's not some shadowy presence that is dictating American politics. It is a corporate super PAC, one of many, that spends to advance a particular outcome. Candidates are free to engage with it or not. And these donors, some of them have come to suspect that attacking AIPAC is kind of a smokescreen for attacking maybe other Jews who have any sort of positive feelings about Israel. And we have actually seen this play out in other progressive movements and progressive spaces, not necessarily El-Sayed, but some other groups have sort of started to use AIPAC as a blanket term for any Jew who is not explicitly anti-Israel.
Andrew Lapin is a senior reporter for the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. You can read his recent reporting about the Michigan Democratic primary for an open U.S. Senate seat at jta.org. Andrew, thank you so much for your work and for talking to us about it.
Thank you so much. It was great to be here.
We're going to pause for just a moment now. When we return, we get right into a conversation about birds and conservation in America.
When they would pass over, they would literally raise a wind and it would sound like thunder. I mean, this was an epic spectacle of nature.
That's next. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. From bald eagles to spring robins and migrating geese, the birds all around us are markers of our time and place. But the American fascination with birds has not always been to the birds' benefit. From the Victorian appetite for hat feathers, to hunters, to feral house cats, humans have had a pretty massive impact on populations of American bird species over the last couple of hundred years. But for almost as long, there have been people working to save birds. James McCommons is a journalist and professor emeritus at Northern Michigan University. He documents these conservation efforts in his recent book, The Feather Wars and the Great Crusade to Save America's Birds. Jim McCommons, welcome to Stateside. It's great to have you.
Thank you for having me.
You have written about our relations with nature and with species before. What got you thinking about bird populations?
Well, the second book that I did was about George Shiras III, who was a wildlife photographer and did most of his work in the Upper Peninsula. But the other thing that George did was he was the father of the Migratory Bird Act. He, in 1904, introduced a bill, which at that time didn't pass, but really introduced the concept of the federal government taking over jurisdiction over birds. And so when I was researching that book, I had to learn a lot about the early 20th century and the bird movement, and I saw that there was a bigger story to tell. And that's how I got interested in this subject.
It's hard, I think, in this moment in history to get a head around how different hunting was in the 19th century in this country and the kind of demands that it filled. What were the reasons people were hunting birds?
So people were hunting for subsistence ever since European colonization, but there was also market hunting. People were selling wildlife. Wildlife was a commodity for a long time. And market hunting went well into the early 20th century. And then there was sport hunting. Sport hunting came along more after the Civil War, when a lot of people had moved during the Gilded Age into the cities. This was a way for them to go out and experience nature. Mm. And so there was sport hunting, subsistence hunting, and then there was this market hunting. And market hunting was devastating to all kinds of animals, such as passenger pigeons. Buffalo on the Great Plains, they were hunting for hide and meat. And so that would happen with birds as well. And there was the feather hunting that went on as well.
Supplying the fashion trade.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
And I was just floored. Like, the thought of a brooch or earrings with a hummingbird head on it blew my mind.
Oh, yeah. It began with having a feather in your cap, in your hat. And then it really turned into these ostentatious hats that had feathers, that had stuffed birds. And then it was using pieces of birds, feathers, heads, and things like that in brooches, earrings, the way that they would trim dresses. And so it just grew over time.
You mentioned the passenger pigeon. I think a lot of people who are hearing us right now are aware that there was a bird called the passenger pigeon that used to be extremely common in North America and is now extinct. But I did not grasp the scale of the loss and just what the passenger pigeon was all about before I picked up your book. Can you describe how large the passenger pigeon flocks were?
In the billions. It was an eastern bird from the Mississippi River to the Atlantic coast. It was a woodland bird. And of course, when Europeans first started coming here, the canopy was relatively unbroken between the river and the ocean. Those birds would migrate. And as they would migrate north and south, they would pass over places. And they would sometimes take hours to pass. The flocks were hundreds of miles long.
When you say billions, we mean billions in one flock.
It could be. Or at least hundreds of millions. There were sometimes different flocks, but the birds would concentrate. They were looking to land and roost as they came north in areas where they could eat acorns and other kinds of nuts. But when they would pass over, they would literally raise a wind and it would sound like thunder. I mean, this was a epic spectacle of nature that people would come to see in the spring, and then they saw it disappear over time. And so that was part of what motivated a lot of people to save birds, was that they actually saw the bounty of all these birds and then saw them disappear to the point that they became extinct within their lifetime.
There's a great deal of interesting detail in this book about how people have hunted in North America, how European-American people have hunted in North America. I'd never heard of the punt gun before this, which I'm sure folks with Delaware roots or Maryland roots may be very familiar with. There's fascinating stuff on the technology of cold storage. And obviously, that's been a huge help to modern life, but it meant huge problems for bird species in terms of their value as a market commodity. But you also educated me a lot on how common it was for nature lovers to collect both birds and bird eggs to study and to stuff, and that this was a part of how people interacted with nature. Do you want us to understand these habits more as a factor in species loss or in the close relationship with nature that helped to turn the tide?
Yeah, at that time, if you were interested in birds, you basically stole their nest. You would shoot the bird and you would bring it home and stuff it in these study skins. That was the way that people got into it. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about it was I wanted to show the evolution from what they call shotgun ornithology to sight ornithology, which is what we all know today, using field guides and using binoculars, optics. But those optics, those field guides were not available in the early part of the ornithology movement in the country. And so this is how people interacted with wildlife. So it definitely did depress bird populations locally to shoot these birds or to take their eggs on a scale, not so much the scale of with feather hunting, but it did make a difference without a doubt. And oology is what they used to call egg collecting at that time. And some of that was done for scientific purposes. But what I wrote about in the book was a lot of it was done as a collecting craze, that people just loved to get these eggs from birds that they could display in their cabinets of curiosity in their parlors at home, along with fossils and seashells and those kind of things. And that was the way people expressed their interest in nature at that time.
Yeah. Do you see science around the turn of the 20th century as helping people understand bird species? Or science as practiced in this way, feeding the fire that consumed species?
Well, originally, I think in the late 19th century, there was not a lot of understanding of wildlife science. And so there was not an understanding how they were sort of herding birds. But that did change, and there was an emergence of more wildlife science into the 20th century. And eventually, in the 1920s and 1930s, we had discovered things like the flyways, where birds migrated to, and the importance of nesting areas and some of those kind of things. And that's where you start to see conservation, because you now have universities that are turning out people who have a science background. There was no place for someone to go to study to be an ornithologist until well into the 20th century.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Jim McCommons. He is professor emeritus at Northern Michigan University and the author of the brand new book this year, The Feather Wars and the Great Crusade to Save America's Birds. Jim, you know, a lot of people have heard of the name Audubon, which has come to include a lot of baggage. But this book does a wonderful job at introducing us, you know, taking us beyond Audubon to meet George Grinnell, Charles Halleck, Florence Merriam, who had a big part to play in popularizing opera glass ornithology, the idea that you didn't have to shoot at something to love and appreciate it, and also a man named John Burroughs. Can we maybe just take a moment and tell us a little bit about his role in awakening the public about species loss?
Well, John Burroughs was a writer in the sort of in the canon of Henry David Thoreau, and wrote nonfiction essays in many of the popular magazines at that time, The Atlantic, The Century magazine, and then also was writing books. One of the things that Burroughs liked to talk about was that people could find the divine in nature, that this was a place to go to calm down because of life was getting faster, less pastoral, and that birds were your most accessible bit of nature, and that you could find the divine in your backyard with birds and nature. Burroughs was a really interesting character. He lived in the Catskill Mountains. He wrote a lot of his essays in a cabin called Slabsides outside of Poughkeepsie, which is still there today. I visited and went there to see it. He also became like a spiritual guru, not just to Americans in general, but he became a spiritual guru to people like Henry Ford. He used to go on those camping trips with Henry Ford and Thomas Edison. That was in his later years. But Burroughs was an important figure during that time. I sort of called him the guru to the bird preservation movement. And a very beautiful writer. A lot of people don't read John Burroughs today, but John Burroughs did some wonderful writing.
Can you lay out who the major factions were on the side of the conservationists?
So the major factions being like the sport hunters, the ornithologists. Many of the ornithologists, even though they were shotgun ornithologists, they looked upon the killing of birds for feathers and for market hunting. They looked askance at that. It was the ornithologists, the sport hunters, and the bird lovers. And the bird lovers at that time were known as bird sentimentalists. They were people who loved birds for the aesthetic.
That's such a great phrase.
Yeah. I liked it too.
Yeah.
And Florence Merriam was one of those people that really introduced the idea, again, of looking at birds through sight ornithology with several of her books. She was part of that Audubon movement. And then it was George Bird Grinnell. And George Bird Grinnell was one of those people who sort of straddled both the hunting community and the bird sentimentalist community. And he was the one who started the Audubon movement in his magazine, Forest and Stream. And it didn't last because he simply couldn't run both Audubon magazine and Forest and Stream. But eventually it was picked up later by some other people.
Likewise, the opposition that conservationists were facing had a little bit of a different character than we understand in political battles today. How do you describe what they were up against?
Well, initially, I think they were up against the idea that many people had that nature was endless, that you could continue to harvest these animals and that there would always be more.
Never run out of trees, never run out of birds.
That's right. And so why did they think that? Because they hadn't run out of them before. The United States was a big place, and there was always more land to conquer. There was always more frontier. And so, yeah, there was that mentality that really permeated a lot of the 19th century. And only towards the end were they realizing that things were not limitless. And you had the disappearance of the buffalo, which, of course, was in the tens of millions, and the disappearance of the passenger pigeon. And for a lot of people, that was a wake-up call. The politicians, particularly on the federal level, were not anxious to have the federal government regulate wildlife within their states. The idea back then was that states owned the wildlife within their borders and that the federal government had no jurisdiction. And the federal government also didn't really have much interest in doing that. That came later. The federalization of wildlife, of protecting wildlife, really came in the early 20th century. And a lot of it came around with Theodore Roosevelt.
Right.
Right. Who was asserting himself in many ways.
The shift in the book from the Golden Age and just the unbridled capitalism, the deep oppression, and in many cases, the slaughter of Native nations, to a period of just a different understanding of the United States' relationship with nature. Do you think that things would have progressed in the same way without the complicated figure of Theodore Roosevelt?
That's hard to say. It really is. He was a person who came along at, you could say, the right time when things were really at a low ebb. He also had that background of being a person who was very interested in nature. I said that Roosevelt was a birdman. He was as well-trained as any ornithologist at that time and just as knowledgeable. So he always loved birds, and he had the chance, of course, when he became president, to start setting aside those bird refuges. There were a lot of other people at the time, too. He didn't certainly do it alone. There were a lot of other people at the time who were raising the alarm. George Bergrinnell was one of them within Forest and Stream. George Shiras was one as well when he was a congressman at that period. So I think there was a realization from a lot of the politicians who were following the popular opinion in America. The politicians came along later, but there had really been a sea change in how people were thinking about nature and thinking about birds. Part of that was the Audubon movement that was raising awareness and consciousness amongst people.
As I was reading, I just felt always reminded that the loss of these bird species, some of them haven't really recovered ever. And the slaughter of bison, as you say, that's something that America still lacks, although there have been some conservation wins. But you do tell this one story that was unknown to me, some other Michiganders may not know, about the Canada goose.
Oh, yes.
Which I was floored to learn had almost completely disappeared. And there's a preserve in northern Michigan that played a big role in bringing it back. Do you mind telling us about it?
No, I think that's something that surprised a lot of people, that the Canada goose was a fairly rare bird around the turn of the century. And well into the 1930s, it was a popular animal for the market hunters to kill. And so they literally shot every one of them that they would see. It was one of the birds that was really threatened at that time. And the Seney National Wildlife Refuge, which is in the central part of the Upper Peninsula, it's about 90,000 acres, was created in the 1930s with the Civilian Conservation Corps coming in and the federal government taking what had been the Manistique Swamp that had been cut. The trees had been cut. It had been drained with the idea that they were going to farm it, which was one of those kind of things that was happening around the country. That was what they call submarginal land for agriculture. So the federal government was able to buy it up or even condemn part of that land and take it back. And then they created the Seney National Wildlife Refuge in the 1930s with the CCC providing the labor. One of the very first missions that they had was to bring back the Canada goose. And so there were some geese that were being farmed by some folks, and they were able to bring in, and they started to raise them on the refuge. Of course, the birds would migrate. Some would stay, And then those flocks would build up, and then they were moved to different areas. And eventually, we saw the comeback of the goose. Now, the same thing happened with turkeys as well.
Absolutely wild.
Right. So the goose today, which was a threatened bird, is now considered a bird of least concern.
Journalist and educator James McCommons is the author of The Feather Wars and The Great Crusade to Save America's Birds, all about landmark bills passed from the Gilded Age through the 20th century. You can find it at a fine independent bookseller near you. Jim McCommons, thank you so much for talking to us about the book.
I appreciate you having me.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you for listening.